Hello and welcome to Animal Voices. You're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm your host, Lauren, here with news person Sue Teubner and a very special guest in studio today, Amanda Swift, who is the co-founder of TARS, the Toronto Animal Rights Society. And as always, our wonderful, lovely tech, Lamia, thank you for teching. Today's show, I think, is going to be a lot of fun. We're going to be talking about vegan baking. So if you've ever had any questions about whether or not vegan baking was even possible, I think for some people it might be a bit of a misnomer. How can you bake without eggs? It is possible, and it's great. You can make things that don't taste like tofu pies or lentil cakes or things like that. You can make things that are just as sweet and decadent as you would make with conventional ingredients. And Amanda is going to be sharing with us some of her wisdom. She's an incredible baker. I've sampled some of her things before, and she's going to tell us about some of the tricks of the trade in terms of baking with no animal products. And also joining us will be Kirsten from the Sticky Fingers Bakery based out of Washington, D.C. And for people who are interested in learning a bit more about the products that they offer, you can go to www.stickyfingersbakery.com and you will salivate all over your computer, I guarantee it. They have figured out a way to make this ridiculously rich cream using no animal products, and it looks absolutely divine. I have a friend who's gone and actually visited the bakery, and she said that the sticky buns are out of the world, the cinnamon buns. So we're going to talk with her about founding the bakery and why she got into this. And we're going to do a bit of a roundtable discussion as we field some questions that listeners sent us about their vegan baking woes. But before we jump into the interview, we're going to hear some news from Sue.
Great. Thanks, Lauren. In all the wake of the mad cow information that's going around, I'm actually going to start off with just some information about fish. Because like we know, a lot of people who stop eating red meat are still eating fish. Well, a new study published last Friday in the journal Science has found that farm-raised Atlantic salmon, which is one of the world's most popular health foods, are so laced with PCBs and other pollutants that they should be eaten only infrequently because they pose an increased risk of cancer. Salmon from Toronto supermarkets were so contaminated that they shouldn't be eaten more than once every 2 months, while those from Vancouver were safe to eat only once a month, according to the study. And research have blamed the feed that they use on fish farms for concentrating ocean pollutants. Wild salmon were also studied, but were given a clean bill of health. They were found to have much lower level of pollutants and could be eaten up to 8 times a month. So it's good to know that they still have pollutants, but you can eat them more. Both Health Canada and the Canadian Food Inspection Agency officials disputed the need for consumption restrictions and are quoted as saying, in Canada, the fish is safe, much like the cows. Health Canada has been trying to promote fish as a healthy alternative for protein, certainly not trying to restrict its intake. In addition, the study also tested salmon raw with the skin on, so they were saying that by removing the skin and grilling it, it removes a significant amount of PCBs, dioxin, and other pollutants stored in the fish fat. And just FYI, farm salmon production has risen about 40% over the past 2 decades to more than 1 million tons a year. And more than half of the salmon consumed worldwide now comes from farm sources. Going on to just some information about cows. And last Tuesday, Alberta Premier Ralph Klein said Alberta may test all cattle slaughtered at a provincial facility for BSE in an effort to restore international confidence in the beef industry in Canada. He's ordered a cost analysis on a proposal, and that's actually a reversal of his previous stance that Alberta beef was safe and didn't need to go through expensive testing. Makes you go, Currently, Canada requires testing only for meat from cows that seem ill as they reach the slaughterhouse door. By contrast, Japan tests all of its slaughtered cattle for BSE, and Alberta is now desperate to have the Japanese market reopened to shipments of Canadian beef since it was closed down since the discovery of BSE last May in Canada. Canadian farmers are now bracing for an extension of such sanctions, especially after the DNA test confirmed that the Holstein infected with the case in Washington was born in Alberta. Moving on as well about, there's a lot of information on mad cow this week because it's still news big time, so lots of stuff still out there. But in Ottawa, federal officials have ruled out a ban on feeding slaughterhouse waste to cattle, even though some government scientists are saying that such a ban is the only way to be sure of stopping mad cow disease. Brian Adams, Evans, who's the chief veterinarian for the Canadian Food Inspection Agency, has said that such a ban would not be based on science and would be impossible to enforce. Britain and other European countries have maintained such a ban for years, and it has been under study in Canada. And this veterinarian said a panel of foreign experts advise against the idea and that the European approach is based on public perception rather than science. He also said it's not science-based to ban everything, and he's quoted as saying, to ban fish meal, to ban everything, to ban other species where BSE has never been diagnosed. Under current Canadian regulations, cattle cannot be fed remains from other ruminants, including sheep and deer, which can carry the brain-wasting diseases linked to BSE. But cattle can still be fed the remains of horses, pigs, chickens, and fish. Nice to know what's going into your steak. Cattle blood and fat can be used in cattle feed, and many calves are weaned on cattle blood. And also, cattle remains can be fed to other animals, such as pigs and horses. And critics are saying there's a risk of cross-contamination at feed mills, and some scientists suggest cattle blood could be infective as well. According to Canada Press, last May, four Health Canada scientists urged Assistant Deputy Minister Diane Gorman in a letter to ban the use of slaughterhouse waste and feed. And their part of the letter says, we consider that the primary cause for the transmission and spread of this disease, animal feeds containing rendered materials of other animals, has been allowed to prevail for much too long. We urge that to contain this disease, a complete and immediate ban must be placed on the use of all such materials and any kind of food and other products for both people and animals. And then a number of other scientists and consumer groups have also called for a ban. And if anyone recalls a couple weeks ago, Gene Boston was on the show, and it was very cool talking to him. In light of having me on the show, it's kind of cool that while talking that day to him about downers and everything else, that same day, the U.S. announced that it would ban the use of downers, which is really, you know, it's also cool because Farm Sanctuary has been fighting so long for getting downers out of the slaughterhouses.
Sue, can you explain what downers are for folks?
Downers are basically any animals that arrive at the slaughterhouse unable to walk or too sick or injured to go into the slaughterhouse. And a lot of times in, like in Canada still and down in the States, they're basically dragged out of the trucks using chains or tractors or whatever and hauled out. And a lot of critics say that, you know, if you've got these sick animals going in there, obviously there's other sicknesses going on and that's causing diseases. And I mean, people are eating these animals that are too sick to even walk in there. And meanwhile, they can still slaughter them and sell them for human consumption. So, I mean, they're saying it's absolutely insane. So since then, the U.S. has announced major changes. And what they're actually doing is they've banned downers and They've announced that all downer cattle, anyone who's unable to stand up at the slaughterhouse door because they're sick or injured, will be banned from the food chain. All animals will be tested for BSE and will not be deemed fit for human consumption and will be held there until confirmation that they've tested negative against the disease. And with the case of the Washington cow, this was not done. Any materials from the head, brain, spinal column, cheeks, and tongue of cattle 30 months or older and a small intestine of any cattle of any age will be prohibited from the human food system. Makes me wonder, though, where are those parts going? Well, they're going to start going into animal food. So, I mean, you're going to have, you know, possible issues coming up with your animals because we all know that a lot of the stuff that goes into cat and dog food is just garbage. Further processing controls are going to be implemented in facilities to remove small amounts of meat from carcasses without breaking bones. And mechanically separated meat, which you see in a lot of, like, the really cheap foods out there, like the chicken noodle soup and all that kind of stuff. Anything like that will be banned entirely from the human food chain.
It just sounds so bizarre. Mechanically separated
meat. I know. I've always wondered, like, what is mechanically separated meat, you know, compared to something else? It's like, whatever. Yeah. And air injection stunning of cattle will be prohibited, and that's to decrease the risk of any brain material becoming dislodged during an animal slaughter. So it's nice to see, like, the states are taking steps. Now, in light of that, there's a Canadian Coalition for Farm Animals, and they're actually calling upon the Canadian government to follow suit as well and to stop downers from going into Canadian slaughterhouses. And Deborah Probert, who's the executive director of the Vancouver Humane Society and who's the CCFA co-founder, said, it's astounding that the images from the outbreak in the UK a few years ago have not changed the way we raise and slaughter animals, animal use for food in North America. Amid discussions about economic devastation to North America's beef industry, the root cause of BSE lies in the unnatural way modern beef production treats animals, the result of feeding animals to animals. And while it is now illegal in Canada to feed cows to cows, it remains perfectly legal to feed cow's blood to calves and dead cows to non-ruminants such as pigs and chickens. Mm. So they are actually going to the government and calling for a ban on all downer animals within Canada. And, I mean, especially in Canada, because it has been documented that cows with broken backs, internal organs spilling out, and crippling injuries have been transported to slaughter in spite of the Federal Health of Animals regulations prohibiting loading or transporting an animal who cannot be moved without undue suffering. And they also talk about many downers are dairy cows or breeding pigs, which is also raising the issue of on-farm animal welfare, which is not addressed by any federal or provincial legislation. Probert says, these animals are going down on the farm. They are byproducts of an industry that should be accountable to the public. The public must ask itself, what is the real price of meat, milk, and eggs? What is the price to the animals? Banning the feeding of animals to animals together with a ban on transporting downer animals is the only hope of eradicating this disease. And, of course, she doesn't go into the whole animal suffering issue either. Mm-hmm. But I guess, you know, sometimes you need to touch on the whole, you could get sick by eating this, you know, and then go on to other issues of compassion.
It's so interesting, you know, with the downer issue, because I think when I first started looking at the meat industry and the issues in terms of welfare, that you'd think that downers would be a relatively uncommon phenomenon. But the fact that they're, you know, people are working for a ban against mm-hmm. against processing downers, you know, just speaks to the astronomical numbers. Like, it's really incredible how many animals are injured by the time they arrive.
Oh, definitely.
At the slaughterhouse.
In this, I'm not sure what it is for Canada. In the States, they say it's between 30 to 40,000 cattle each year arrive as downers at slaughterhouses. And that's just cattle. I mean, yeah. You're not including pigs. I mean, chickens are one of the most, one of the most abused birds out there. So, I mean, yeah. You know, you just can't even imagine the number of chickens, especially if you've seen footage of how they transport chickens yeah. and when they catch chickens and toss them yeah. into the crates. So, I mean, you just imagine what the numbers are for that when you yeah. factor those in.
Yeah, especially with laying hens, because they're forced to produce so many eggs that the calcium is really leached out mm-hmm. of their bones. So they're quite brittle by the time they're being yanked out of their cages once they're so-called spent.
Yeah.
And so that ends up fracturing a lot of the bones, because their legs and toes and everything have actually grown into the cages quite often.
Definitely.
So you have to yank quite hard to get the birds out.
To get them right out.
Yes. Yeah, some of the, well, you know, as a couple of workers that I've talked to just talked about the sound of breaking bones as you're yanking them out of the cages. I don't know how they would even begin to regulate downers in terms of the chicken industry.
I have no idea. I mean,
yeah.
That's, you know, I think it's more so we have to concentrate on one area at a time. And I think that's what Farm Sanctuary basically does. You know, you get it, the information out there for everything, but, you know, you concentrate on veal crates or you concentrate on gestation crates, and you just do it one slow step at a time, because each slow step gets you a little bit further ahead, though, in the long run.
Yeah.
I only have one last little bit of news, and this was actually a request that was sent to Lauren. It's to honor the memory of a 1.5-year-old chocolate lab named Sun Bear, who was cruelly starved to death. And it also goes to show you sometimes that justice, I mean, it does catch up. Herbert Wilmer was arrested in August 2002 for starving his pet dog, Sun Bear, to death in Cross Lanes, West Virginia. And it was his former girlfriend who discovered the dog when she entered the vacant townhouse that he had once occupied. When the chocolate lab was found, he weighed 25 pounds. And there is an actual picture on the email that was sent. And, I mean, it's so sad to see him. At 25 pounds, he's about a quarter of his normal weight. It was reported by the humane officer that when Sun Bear finally made his way out of the condominium, the dog staggered across the yard, rolled down a bank to a nearby creek to get a sip of water. And they had said that they had figured he could have been without food or water for like up to like 6 weeks or something. But Wilmer actually took off. So they offered a reward for the arrest and conviction of the person responsible for the dog's death. He was arrested, then he failed to appear for two court appearances. He took off, he made his way to Indianapolis, and it just so happens that one of the employees recognized him from another restaurant he had worked at. He reported to an area supervisor who had just actually hired him and was still doing a background check, and I guess something clicked, so he put his name into the internet, one of the search engines, and his name popped up. It was a newspaper article reporting his arrest. So the end result was basically the supervisor called the police, and he kept him occupied, and authorities arrived and arrested him. So he has been sent back, And jury trial's being set for February 23rd this year. So hopefully justice will be served for Sun Bear. If any good has come out of that, the state of West Virginia has since then passed a felony-level animal cruelty law. So at least their cruelty laws have been increased now. And hopefully, you know, anyone else who's convicted, they will face stiffer penalties, especially if they do anything as sad as this.
Thanks, Sue, for sharing with us the weekly news. You're listening to Animal Voices, CIUT 89.5. We're going to come back and do the program on vegan baking. Amanda Swift from the Toronto Animal Rights Society is here to share her wisdom about baking. And we're also going to be speaking with Kirsten Rosenberg from the Sticky Fingers Bakery in Washington, D.C. So please stay tuned. We're going to field a lot of questions about baking with no animal products. So it should be a great show. Welcome back to Animal Voices, CIUT 89.5. Today's show on Animal Voices, we are going to be talking about vegan baking, and Kirsten Rosenberg hopefully is on the line. She is from the Sticky Fingers Bakery in Washington, D.C. She co-founded it with her friend Doran Peterson. And also today in studio is Amanda Swift, and she's going to be talking with us about vegan baking as well, and I hope that you can give us a bit of an update about the vegan cooking classes that are going to be happening as well. Kirsten, are you on the line?
I sure am.
Is it Kirsten or Kirsten?
It's Kirsten.
Kirsten, all right, could we get that out of the way? Kirsten, thanks for being on the program today.
Thanks for having me.
I'm going to get Amanda maybe to introduce herself first, just give her a little bit of background, and then we'll come back to you and find out about how you started the Sticky Fingers Bakery.
Yeah, sure.
Thanks so much for having me on the show, Lauren. Well, I'm the one of the co-founders of the Toronto Animal Rights Society. I've been interested in vegan cooking and vegan baking for quite a long time, pretty much ever since I went vegan and thought that I couldn't have cookies and pancakes and all sorts of delicious things anymore. But that's not true, which is very fortunate. So I'm going to be starting up doing cooking classes pretty soon. Basically, I want to be able to teach people all the things that I didn't know when I first went vegan and went vegetarian, because it is different from what most people are used to in terms of cooking. There's a lot of different foods that you use and different techniques and things like baking and replacing eggs. There's some tricks that you really need to know.
Cool. So hopefully we'll get a chance to talk about those today. Kirsten, can you tell us a bit about your role at the Sticky Fingers Bakery and what the bakery is all about?
Sure. My partner, Doran Peterson, founded the bakery. She was just, you know, baking stuff on the side. She had another full-time job and was just renting time in local commercial kitchens and baking stuff for people on the side. And then an opportunity came up to take over an existing storefront that actually had been a bakery before, and she saw a great opportunity to expand the business, and she wanted to take on a partner to do that, and that's where I came into the picture. And I don't have any baking experience, and you know, I'm just a longtime vegan who's also a foodie and a junk food addict, so I felt quite experienced and to be able to help out on the tasting end of things anyway.
Right.
Both our backgrounds are in animal advocacy, and she actually also has a degree in dietetics, which she's also studied food science. But me, you know, I just came to this. I used to work for the Animals Agenda magazine, and that was a great opportunity for me. I loved being there, and after almost 6 or 7 years, I was looking for something else to do, and this opportunity came along, and I just really believed in what Doran was doing. I had tasted her products at various animal rights conferences and just flipped out over how good they were. So I think she saw a kindred soul and someone she could rope into to getting involved in building up the business.
Right, and it's still a pretty new bakery. It was you founded it in 2001. That's what it says on their website.
October 2002 was our year anniversary for having the store open.
Wow, that's great. You know, I think for a lot of people, there's kind of this idea that baking is a science, and I think it's intimidating for a lot of people. I know I've cooked much longer than I've ever been a baker, because it's sort of more obvious if you screw up and there's less chance to fix it. Amanda, you spoke a little bit about just, you know, feeling when you first went vegan that you wouldn't be able to have all the you know, the tasty foods that you were used to eating in terms of the sweet stuff. So what do you think are some of the misconceptions out there about vegan baking, that it's just not possible? Or,
well, I think probably a lot of people's first experience with vegan baking, if they have any experience at all, is something that they got at a health food store that is just like loaded full of fiber and like flax seeds and something like that. That's just really not the same kind of rich, decadent stuff that you're used to. And they think that that's what all vegan baking has to be like.
It's like dry, right? Bricks.
Okay.
Yeah.
And one of the things about Sticky Fingers Bakery, there's a lot of things that Sticky Fingers Bakery does that are very creamy. And, and it's really amazing. It's like this thick, lush, sweet, creamy stuff that's slathered on various different things, slathered in between cookies, on top of cakes.
It's all about the frosting, baby.
Yeah, and how do you do that? Like, I know that you can't give away the trade secrets, but...
A lot of that stuff is not that difficult. And let me just say up front, we don't market our food as health food, even though there's obviously health benefits to eating things that don't contain eggs or dairy and are naturally cholesterol-free. But we don't market it as health food. I mean, the frosting is made with non-hydrogenated vegetable shortening. Actually, it's Earth Balance, that brand.
Oh.
Confectioner's sugar, vanilla, and either water or soy milk.
Right.
So, you know, you whip that stuff together, and that's for, like, the vanilla. If you're doing chocolate, you'd put in cocoa.
Mm.
And it tastes exactly like regular, good old-fashioned frosting, you know? It doesn't taste like health food.
Mm-hmm.
It's good.
I think the frosting thing is something that gives people... or makes a lot of people scratch their heads. Like, there's a question here about how to make a topping for key lime pie. I recognize that that's not quite frosting, but how to make things that are frothy. There was a question from one of our listeners who asked about if you had any suggestions, or if Amanda had any suggestions for how to make a topping for something like key lime pie.
Well, I think, like, sometimes you can have success using something like silken tofu with a lot of sweeteners and adding some flavorless oil, like canola oil or something like that, drizzling it into the silken tofu in the blender to try to get it to whip up. So things like that are in a lot of vegan cookbooks, but mm-hmm. you definitely need to add, like, some sweeteners and some fat.
Right. Okay, that sounds good. So what about for people maybe who don't aren't familiar with different types of tofu? Silken tofu is very different than sort of the run-of-the-mill tofu that you could get in the deli section of a lot of grocery stores. How are the properties different, and how does it work?
Well, the texture of silken tofu is just completely different. It's much finer, so you can put it in the blender, and it's kind of custard-like. Whereas regular tofu is kind of grainy and harder, and you can slice it up and bake it in a marinade or something like that. But silken tofu, if you whip it in a blender, it has a consistency that's kind of like whipped cream, especially if you add in some canola oil or something like that.
Does it taste tofu-y?
Well, if you don't add anything to it, it tastes tofu-y, but silken tofu has a pretty light flavor. Tofu in general doesn't have a very strong flavor, so that's one of the great things about it, is you can add different flavorings to it, and you can get all sorts of different things. Like, a lot of people are really surprised if they try tofu first in something like a chocolate mousse pie, because they just can't believe that it's tofu. It doesn't taste like there's any tofu at all.
Right. Kirsten, there's a cheesecake that's featured on the Sticky Fingers Bakery website, which, by the way, is an amazing website. There's great pictures.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
It's being updated right now, so
cool.
There are going to be some changes on it, but thank you.
Yeah, a friend of mine wanted me to pass on that she had tried the cinnamon buns, and that
mm-hmm.
she thought they were divine. So, but there's a cheesecake, and two, I think a lot of people probably thinking about how you would make a cheesecake without...
Well,
how do you do it?
Speaking of tofu, that's one thing we don't use in the cheesecake, because, you know, we've all had vegan cheesecakes that are tofu-based, and sometimes they taste really good, but they taste kind of tofu-y, and we definitely didn't want that tofu flavor coming through. So actually, we use a tofu-y cream cheese base, that stuff rocks, man. That makes for some good cheesecake.
Right. A friend of mine uses the tofu-y cream cheese. The thing is that it's kind of expensive if you want to make a whole cake, but, you know, I think it's worth it to do a cheesecake. But you can also buy it through Counterculture, which is up at York University in bulk, which can cut down on your prices. So there are some places in Toronto to get the tofu-y cream cheese that really really does taste like cream cheese.
Mm-hmm. Well, I definitely come from the white trash vegan segment, you know, where the more it tastes like junk food, Susie Q's and Twinkies and stuff like that, the better.
Right.
And actually, that's a big part of what Sticky Fingers is about, is the stuff we do is really, you know, it's not meant to taste any different than its animal-based counterpart.
Right.
You know, it's a great bridge food, really, for people who think, what a vegetarian eat? What do vegans eat?
Yeah.
Our stuff, it doesn't taste any different, and so the less it tastes vegan and the more it tastes like, quote-unquote, real food,
right,
the better, and that's what we're all about.
Yeah, there's always a lot of pressure, I find, if you go to a potluck. And maybe you're the only veg head there, and you go in and you're bringing the vegan dessert or a vegan dish. There's like all of this pressure. It's got to be great. It's got to be over the top good. So it's nice to know that there's ways of making really decadent stuff out there using vegan ingredients. Kirsten, what are some of your favorite products that you guys offer?
Oh gosh, well, it goes in cycles. I'd say certainly the sticky cinnamon buns that you mentioned, something that are called Calvin cookies, which in hindsight we realize is a very cryptic name that no one can either like read the sign or pronounce it or figure out what it's about. It's spelled C-O-W-V-I-N, like as in cows.
Yeah.
There's actually this cow named Calvin out of the sanctuary. But anyway, I digress. That's an oatmeal cookie cream sandwich that's incredible.
Yeah.
And then also our little devil cakes. It's like a Susie Q, basically. Chocolate cake with the creamy filling and some chocolate coating on top. Those are really, I'd say, our signature items because you cannot get that kind of stuff anywhere else. But we do great cookies as well. Chocolate chip, lemon coconut, oatmeal raisin. We got some muffins, you know, cakes, all kinds of cakes. Right now we're doing vegan s'mores and vegan Rice Krispie treats that people are flipping out over.
I really should have brought something that we could all eat in studio because I think everyone's looking hungry right now.
Salivating.
Okay, well, we're in Toronto and we're now torturing ourselves listening to you talk about all these wonderful foods. It is possible, though, to order stuff over the internet, or can you call, or what can you do if you want to get some of those products?
Well, technically the transaction isn't done through the internet, but you can certainly go to our website and email us.
Okay.
And then we'll follow up with an email or a phone call, or you can call us. Not all of our items are available for mail order, but some of them are.
So what are some of the things that people could order from Toronto?
You could definitely order the Calvin cookies. You could order our, we call them the old-fashioned cookies, the chocolate chip, lemon coconut, and oatmeal raisin cookies. You can also order, we do various loaves. We don't ship any, like, decorated cakes, but we'll send, like, a chocolate cake loaf that's undecorated, doesn't have frosting, but it's the chocolate cake, or a carrot cake, or you could get our chocolate chimp banana bread loaf. A banana walnut loaf. So you can get some loaves, things like that. We will send the sticky buns and the little devils if people are adamant about it. But, because, you know, we ship everything 2-day Federal Express.
Right.
So it's not cheap. And, you know, we don't add any preservatives to it. So the stuff is not meant to last for a week or two. You know, it's meant to be eaten within a 1 to 3 days, basically. So some of the stuff I don't think is really appropriate to do mail order, but people still clamor for it.
Yeah.
Even a 2-day-old little devil is better than no little devil in some parts of the country,
well,
apparently.
In terms of ordering stuff from the Sticky Fingers Bakery, it would seem like this is probably, if you're going to order, this would be a pretty decent season to do it because things aren't going to melt quite as quickly.
Yeah, exactly.
So
that is very true.
Yeah, you don't want to order them at the end of July. Put in an order for some
especially
kind of cake.
Especially anything that has chocolate in it because that gets melty.
Yeah.
For sure.
One of the things that surprised me, too, on the website is that there's wedding cakes.
Like
you do
yeah.
special occasions.
Yes.
Do you find it? It's sort of people who are not necessarily vegetarian or vegan who are requesting these things, or people seek you out specifically? I'm vegan.
Well,
I need
both.
This cake.
We certainly get vegans who are so enthralled to find a vegan bakery, but we also get people. We get a lot of food allergy people, lactose intolerant people, or people who have allergies to egg. That is a significant part of our customer base.
What do you guys use for your egg replacers?
We use the, you know, commercial energy egg replacer.
Okay.
And that works fine. I guess, you know, Doran tells me eggs are used for, or they are like a binder and perhaps a leavener as well. And so, you know, Amanda may agree or have something to add on this. It's tricky without eggs. Dairy, no problem. Eggs are more of a pain to get around. But we use that. And some of our denser things, like our muffins, we do use silken tofu as well. And it was funny because I just asked Doran before I got on the phone, so do we use tofu in anything? Because you can't taste it at all.
Right.
So I was surprised. I'm like, oh, we do? Really? Oh,
right.
Okay.
Cool. Yeah, Amanda, what do you think about egg replacers? I tend to use the regular egg replacer, the energy stuff that Kirsten was talking about, but I made muffins for the first time the other day, and I used applesauce, and also I made cookies when I was back at my folks' place in Manitoba, and I used the small town Manitoba, so there's not a lot of, you know, the fancy items. So I used half a banana as a replacement for an egg, and they turned out pretty well, but you could taste the banana in the cookies, which was fine. So what do you use?
I think it depends on the recipe. I usually look at what eggs do in the baking, and depending on the recipe and what their function is, I replace them with different things. Like there's so many things that eggs do, which is why it's so difficult to replace them, like compared to something like dairy, where you can easily use soy milk or nut milk or something like that. They add moisture, they add fat, they add, they bind things together really well. They help to emulsify the fats and the water so that they mix together. Hmm. Because, you know, fat and water doesn't mix very easily. But most importantly, probably the two things are they help things to rise. You can whip up egg whites or eggs and get a whole bunch of little bubbles in them. And you want to have all these little bubbles in your baking, because then the air inside of them will expand and, like, the cake or the muffins or whatever will rise up. The other thing you need is you have to have something that's going to solidify around those bubbles to hold it all up so the cake doesn't fall. And the protein in eggs, when it gets cooked, it does that. So there's actually quite a lot of science between it. But
whoa.
Yeah.
Okay, so now everyone's like, oh no, what do I do? I'm going to have to keep using eggs, or I'm not going to be able to have any great cakes. So how do you get
around
this?
There's so many ways to do that. Like, if you want to get bubbles into something, just like creaming your fat, like non-dairy margarines and things like that, with sugar or you know, other sweeteners that are crystallized, things like that, can get a lot of bubbles in. And then things like flax seeds and water, when you combine like ground up flax with water, or when you boil flax seeds in water, you can get this really great, like, thick, it's exactly the consistency of egg whites, and you can beat that up and get lots of bubbles.
So it's viscous, kind of.
Yeah, it's very, if you ever do it, if you take some ground up flax and you add some hot water to it and let it sit for a couple minutes, and it just gets so thick, just like egg whites. It's really neat.
Can you
actually
taste it?
You can taste it if you use ground up flax a little bit. Like, it's great for things like muffins and cookies, you usually can't. But if you're making this like delicate vanilla cake or something like that, where it's very light flavors, you can boil the flax seeds in water and then you can strain them out, and you just have the gooey stuff left over. So that has like no taste. And then also things like bananas and applesauce and silken tofu blended up, like all these things will also add lots of bubbles in there. And then and adding a bit of extra leavener.
Okay. I have a very limited set of implements that I use in my kitchen. A friend of mine who's a great baker comes over and she says, I like going to your house and baking things because it's like camping. Okay, so I use my Swiss Army knife to cut everything. Like, it's not high tech at all. When you talk about grinding up flax seeds, do you need like a special thing for that? Or what do you have?
I use a coffee grinder. Like a little coffee grinder. They cost about like $15. And I use it for all sorts of different things, but you can actually buy them ground up already.
Okay.
And you can also just like boil them in water and strain them out whole, and that will also work. When I use like flax seeds, I usually also add some extra starch to the baking. I replace about like maybe a quarter cup of the for every 2 cups of flour with tapioca flour or potato starch or something very starchy. This is the stuff in that commercial egg replacer. Basically, commercial egg replacer is just starch and extra leaveners. Hmm. So that the starch helps to, you know, form that structure that the eggs do. So it solidifies when it's baking, it gelatinizes, and you have adding a bit of extra starch will help the baking to not fall.
Mm-hmm. So how does like, if you boil it, the liquid that's left, how does that compare to like the number of eggs you would use? Like, it would be like a tablespoon of liquid compared to an egg?
About a quarter cup. Like, usually about a quarter cup of silken tofu, or a quarter cup of like mashed up fruity stuff like applesauce, or even like pumpkin you could use in things like muffins, stuff like that, or bananas. Or about a quarter cup of that flaxseed goop. Or you can do the easy... Yeah, it's really like amazing stuff.
That's a technical
I wonder
term.
How they figured that out.
I have no idea. It's actually the soluble fiber that's in the flax that does that. It dissolves in the water and it makes it all thick. So it's good, healthy stuff for you.
Mm-hmm.
But the easy way to do it is if you just buy the ground flax, or if you have ground flax that you've ground yourself and keep that in your freezer, you do a tablespoon of that and 3 tablespoons of hot water, and it's pretty much works in anything.
And that equals one egg.
Yeah, okay. Pretty much.
Wow, I just got a whole education there. Yeah. Amanda, you need to come work for Sticky
Bake. Amanda, she's really incredible. I've had some of her muffins, and I don't think I will ever have a muffin as good as hers again. I've been ruined. There's obviously a lot going on with eggs, and so I guess you just have to kind of eyeball and figure out what would be appropriate for the recipe that you're going to be using.
Yeah, pretty much in most recipes, like anything that's like a cake or a muffin or something that rises, if you just like make sure there's lots of bubbles in there, and you make sure that you have some, like maybe a little bit of extra starch usually helps, or something like tofu, the protein in tofu works the same as the protein in eggs. Something like that can really help. But a lot of times in things like muffins, you don't really need that really fine grain like you have in like a cake. So just adding like applesauce and a little bit of extra baking powder, that's what I do in my muffins. Like, it's really quite easy for most of the time. So with some recipes, you kind of have to experiment and see mm-hmm. what works every time you try it. And you'll always get a pretty decent result, but something usually is the thing that makes it perfect.
Yeah. I made muffins the other day, and they didn't turn out at all. And it was my first attempt, really, at muffins. And I felt kind of bad about it, but I figure I'll keep trying. Do you have any suggestions, either of you, for sort of common errors that people make walking into vegan baking that maybe you could tell us about so we don't keep screwing up our muffins and other things?
Well, I guess when you're starting out with baking, like baking is kind of more difficult than something like if you're cooking up like a vegetable stir fry or something, you know, add a little bit of this, and if it doesn't taste right, you can add some more vegetables or you can add something else. It's a bit easier, but baking, you kind of need to have the right balance. So what I usually do is I just like go, like I start off, if you're starting off in baking, start off with recipes that are already out there. Like, there's some good recipes on the Toronto Animal Rights Society website, and there'll be a whole bunch more probably within the next couple of months, and that's at www.animal-rights.ca. There's recipes on there for muffins and cookies. Usually, like, that's what I'll do is I'll look at what other vegan recipes on the internet have used, or most of the time I just look at like a regular old recipe that uses eggs or something like that, and I just replace the eggs using one of the different methods. So,
okay. Do you have favorite cookbooks? I'm just thinking for people maybe who are feeling inspired and want to start baking without animal products. Do you have a particular cookbook that you have found helpful? My friend Brandy, I think it's called Sweet Treats. It's a pink cover. Just recently came out. She loves that cookbook. It's sort of more decadent cookies and things like that.
Yeah, I've heard that there's like a new cookbook that's just come out. I don't have a lot of like really like baking cookbooks. There's a lot of good cookbooks out there, like stuff by Joanne Stepaniak is usually good, but a lot of the vegan cookbooks, unfortunately, are more like that health food kind of thing.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, a tablespoon of canola oil and some flax seeds and some whole wheat flour. And, you know, that's all well and good some of the time, but, you know, you need to be able to have every once in a while that really, really decadent stuff. So I usually go from recipes that aren't vegan and then just replace the ingredients, and that really usually turns out like really, really well.
Yeah. That's what we do as well, typically. Standard recipes and
interesting.
Just substitute.
Huh. And have you done a lot of experimenting there? Do you have new things on the horizon that you want to start incorporating?
Yeah, we're always playing around, and we do stuff seasonal, you know, for the holidays. For the spring, I think we're looking at doing some fruit tarts and some different muffins we just started doing fudge and doing some chocolate peanut butter fudge. And, you know, a lot of it is just what people come in and ask for. And we're like, well, we could try that.
Right.
Okay. Let's get to work on it, team.
So it's an ongoing thing. How many people actually work at the bakery?
Right now we have 3 full-time bakers. There's myself and Doran, and we have a cleaning maintenance guy and one person who works the storefront on the weekends for us. So what does that equal? 5 people?
Right.
6? I don't know.
I have a question here that somebody wrote in that they wanted me to ask. She writes, my question for upcoming vegan bakers is, I've come across baking recipes that use canola oil. Is it a good alternative to olive oil, and does it change the taste of baked goods? So do your guests use it in their baked goods? So do you guys use olive oil or canola oil? I know, Kirsten, you said that a lot of the stuff that you use for the frostings is Earth Balance, which is probably the best vegan margarine out there, by my opinion.
We do use some oil as well, though, some actually liquid oil, and I think we have used canola. I don't think we would ever use olive oil in baking.
Okay. No, I don't think so. It has a very distinct flavor, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So you'd use canola. Is that what
we
you
do?
Yeah?
We do.
All right. Is that what you use too, Meta?
Yeah, usually use canola. You can also use things like sunflower or safflower, but canola is like probably the healthiest for vegans because of the fatty acid profile. So canola is always a good bet, especially organic, because then it's not genetically modified.
All right. And there's a complicated question that later my friend said, you don't have to ask if you don't want to, but this is sort of the like mind-bending question about vegan baking. So this is a guy that's really into canoeing, and he's done some Arctic, he did an Arctic canoe trip, and they did baking when they were canoeing in the Arctic. And so he says here, what would you recommend for baking on canoe trips when you can't bring liquid milk substitutes due to weight limitations? Some of the things that I baked on the trip are bannock, cake, cookies, muffins, and cinnamon buns. In the past, I've used milk powder, but I would like to go vegan on future trips. I've tried powdered soy milk on its own, although not in baking, and I found it chalky and not very good tasting. I could substitute milk with water, but do you have any other recommendations? That's kind of a hard question.
Yeah, that's like extreme
vegan baking.
Right.
I know that there is like soy milk powder. I haven't really tried it a lot, but you might not notice as much in baking. There's some good recipes out there. Like a lot of old cookbooks will have like recipes for things like chocolate cake that use like water and vinegar and canola oil and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And there's no milk or anything in that. Like probably everything in that would be not something perishable or difficult to carry around. Mm-hmm. So that's one idea for sure. And then you have you can get those like aseptic packages of things like soy milk that would travel pretty well. So you probably should be able to replace it with water and maybe add a little bit of extra fat. Like, if you look at what milk actually is, it's basically just fat suspended in water. So it probably wouldn't have too much of an impact on the outcome, I wouldn't think.
Okay. Sweeteners is also something that I wanted to ask about. I know some vegans, they differ on this one in terms of using white sugar or not using white sugar, because some white sugar is refined through using bone char, ground up bones basically, and then filtering the sugar through that to make it that white color. What are some good sweeteners for vegan baked goods?
Well, we use the Florida Crystals evaporated cane juice for wherever it calls for regular granulated sugar. Now, we have, when we were doing pecan pies over the holiday, we did use brown rice syrup. But generally, we tend not to use those kinds of liquid sweeteners and just stick with the Florida Crystals for the granulated sugar. We do use confectioner sugar in our frosting.
Okay. What about you, Amanda? What do you use?
Well, I usually use like organic unbleached sugar. Like I'm not so concerned about stuff like the bone tar. I'm more concerned about, you know, the labor conditions and where it comes from and all that kind of stuff. Because there are animal products in virtually everything.
Yeah, that's definitely how we feel about it too. I mean, but you know, still it is important to, you know, I'm not sure what percentage of our customers, but a portion of them. So we felt it was important to offer instead of the just plain old white sugar.
Yeah.
I think it's about a quarter of, like, sugar. I was reading a while ago, Joanne Stepaniak was talking about this. About a quarter of sugar is filtered with bone char. And it's something like half of cane sugar, something like that. So it's there. But, you know, so like water in a lot of places is also filtered through those bone char filters. So some people may avoid it. But if you want to avoid it, even if you're trying to use like confectioner sugar, which is harder to find in a vegan form, really much more difficult, you can usually get your like sucanat or your unbleached cane sugar and like grind it up with some cornstarch and make like a powdered sugar alternative, which can work if you really want to do that. But sugar, the crystallized sugar is kind of important in baked goods if you're creaming it with the fat, because it does, all the little crystals do poke all sorts of little holes in it. It's kind of chemically important. You can also like get date sugar and maple sugar and different things like that would also serve the same purpose. And maple syrup, of course, is, like, great because it's you can get it made in Canada, and it's just delicious.
Right on.
Yeah.
So is there any tips for just vegan baking in general? I'm thinking, like, when I made some vegan cookies with my friend who is this expert, she said, okay, take them out before you think that they're ready because you don't want to bake them as long as you would conventional cookies. I don't know if that's true right across the board or just the recipe that we were working with, but it seemed like there might be some things about the way that baked goods cook if they're vegan that might be a bit different.
I've found that, like, with some cookies. I'm not sure if it's just the fact that they're vegan. I'm not sure what it is in the cookies that do that, but I have, like, molasses cookies that I make, and, like, they have, like, ginger cookies with, like, lots of molasses in it, and you have to take those out when they're still pretty soft. So I've found that, too. I think you just have to experiment, I guess, and see and follow recipes first and see what works. And then once you've done that a couple times, you get much more confident and much more able to be creative.
Mm-hmm. Kirsten, do you ever have people ask you why you both started up Sticky Fingers in terms of, this is just kind of strange, it's a vegan bakery, it even has in this the slogan, vegan sweets, so irresistible you can't keep your paws off them. Are people, do sometimes people, and they've got, it's got this really cool, in the logo, there's this really cool raccoon who's wrapping around, it looks like a cinnamon bun, and the veganism is kind of out there, it's not like you guys are trying to hide it, just the average person, do they wonder why you're doing this? What do you give
sure.
as an explanation?
Well, you know, it's funny, I mean, we walk the line, like, our sign that's out above our door on the street, it just says Sticky Fingers Bakery, it doesn't say a vegan bakery.
Right.
But when you come inside, you know, it's on our literature, it's on our aprons, it's, you know, we don't hide it in the store certainly, but we really didn't want to deter anybody from just walking in off the street. And it's funny because we have a lot of repeat customers come back time and time again, and then somehow they'll figure out it's vegan, I don't know, they'll finally read it somewhere or see it, and they're like, well, oh, this stuff is vegan? Mm-hmm. They're like, yeah, and they're like, oh, I had no idea.
Yep.
So that's always, we love that. It gives us such a high when people do that. But, yeah, I mean, sure, people ask about it. And really, the philosophy behind it, clearly there can be a lot of thought and science that goes into making top-notch vegan baked goods. But the important thing is, at the end of the day, if you do it right, it tastes every bit as good, if not more delicious, than the old traditional animal-based counterparts. And you know, we really want to help mainstream the concept of veganism.
Yay!
That's really what it's about for us, you know, and this is such a fun way to do it because both my partner and myself, our backgrounds are in animal advocacy, as I mentioned, and as we all know, you know, as animal rights activists, you're constantly, or you're often in situations where it's confrontational, it's unpleasant, it's combative, it's depressing. And here to be in a bakery where generally the interactions are positive and happy and you're still, you know, helping to promote veganism, it's really awesome. And we want people to realize you don't have to give up anything. Mm. You don't have to sacrifice anything. You can, you know, literally have your cake and eat it too.
Right.
And we want it to be like a fun, positive experience. Like, yes, we're vegans. This is a vegan bakery, but we're all about having fun, and
right.
You know, we're not about depriving, or we're not dour. You know, you come and it looks like a regular bakery.
There's so many stereotypes, you know, about, I think about vegans' vegan diet, you know, like, you're unfun, you got no sense of humor, you eat cardboard, you know,
exactly.
All these different things. And so, I mean, that's the thing that really struck me, too, about this, the website, is it shakes up so many of those different, so many of those stereotypes.
That's what we try to do.
Yeah, that's awesome. Amanda, you are going to be starting up some vegan cooking classes, and I think that's such an essential component to doing advocacy, people knowing how to eat vegan food in terms of preparing and stuff like that. I want to make sure before we run out of time that you can plug that a bit more and how people can get in contact with you and how long the cooking classes run and what type of stuff you'll be learning how to make.
Okay, well, basically the cooking classes I'll be doing are geared towards people who are new to vegetarianism or veganism, or people who are vegans or vegetarians that just have no idea how to cook, they're new to cooking, or they don't eat a lot of a very varied diet because they just don't really know what they can make. So the classes are basically going to teach people, like, a lot of the theory behind vegan cooking and how to work with all these foods that a lot of people really have no idea what to do with, like tofu and seitan and tempeh and things like that. Most people haven't even heard of things like that a lot of times. So, also replacing eggs, how to replace animal products, good, like, cheese alternatives, all sorts of really useful things. So it should be really fun. We'll also talk about nutrition and meal planning and, all, like, just basically all the things I wish I knew when I was going vegan, all that stuff.
Cool.
For sure.
And so when do they start, and how do they get in touch with you, and how much do they cost, and all those different types of details?
Well, they're starting up in February, so I think the first one's on February 7th. It's a session of 8 different classes, and it's $240 altogether, which is pretty reasonable for all the vegetarian cooking classes in Toronto. So to get in contact with us, you can either email me at cookingclasses@animal-rights.ca or check out our website and email anyone on there.
Super.
Yeah.
Yeah, and if you ever hear anything on the show, too, that you want more information about through Animal Voices, you can always write us at the program, and I can forward on the email to any of our guests. You can write animalvoices@ciut.fm. That's Animal Voices, all one word, @ciut.fm. And I wanted to make sure, too, before we close the show, which went really fast, to give the Sticky Fingers Bakery website again, if only for eye candy, even if you're not going to order anything.
That's right, or you have something to look forward to when you come to Washington, D.C.
Yeah, I think I'll probably end up ordering stuff for gifts to friends who are in that area.
Cool, well, we do gift certificates, too.
Cool. So the website is www.stickyfingersbakery.com. And do you have a phone number if people don't have access to the web?
Yeah, sure. 202-299-9700.
Super. Thanks so much for being on the show today.
Hey, thank you, and good luck to you both. You're doing great stuff, and I so thank you for having me on the show.
You've been listening to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5. In studio with us today was Amanda Smith. We were just speaking with Kirsten Rosenberg, who is one of the co-founders of the Sticky Fingers Bakery, which is based out of Washington, D.C. Sue Teubner doing the news and adding her comments as well, and Lamia doing the tech. I'm your host, Lauren, and stay tuned for the next program, and we'll be back next week on Animal Voices.